Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello everyone, I'm Stephen Robb and you're all very welcome along to The Tillage Podcast. It's currently Wednesday, the 16th of March 2022, and we're recording the podcast a day earlier this week because the paper is in shops a day earlier this week due to St. Patrick's Day. So as always, to run through your key tillage stories off the week, I'm joined by tillage editor Andy Doyle, but our colleague Siobhan Walsh is on some well-deserved R&R this week, so it's just the two of us. Andy, it looks like we're in for a bit of a settle spell. The weather seems to have finally turned. Are we likely to see the commencement of the real bulk of the spring sowing now over the coming days?
I would say the answer to that question is yes. Yes, Stephen, I was speaking to some people today who hope to be back out planting by the weekend. Now, it depends a little bit on where you are, because the parts of the south of the country have got quite a bit of rain, south, southeast corner. Other areas not so far away might have had an awful lot less rain over the past week, week and a half. So it just depends on how wet the land is. But I would say that we will see drills moving by this weekend, on the back of the fact that the forecast seems to be solid with lots of zeros, kind of a minimum of three zeros for every section of the country, and some of them have five zeros and only one male in the forecast for the next week. Forecast doesn't make the weather, we all accept and know that, but it's at least good that we seem to be moving into a dry and settled spell again.
How are temperatures likely to look now over the coming week, and what soil temperatures are at the moment?
Temperatures, daytime temperatures are set to rise kind of up into the 12-13 bracket on the warmer days, which will mean that some areas will be higher than that. Soil temperatures have been slow to rise. But again, I think if we can go through a spell with no rain, I think we will see soil temperatures rise. You know, they were much higher a month and a half ago than they are now, when they're generally below 8 degrees across the country. But they could rise a degree and a half on a given day if there was a nice, gentle, warm breeze out there. So they'll come up quick enough. But we will see growth temperatures during the day. But nighttime temperatures are still going to be low, looking back at a lot of zeros in the forecast are a little better than zero. Again, it'll always depend on where you are in the country.
Yeah, okay. In this week's management notes, Andy, you were talking about spring beans, and you mentioned there seems to be a reluctance among some growers to grow beans this year. Just elaborate on that. Why do you think that is?
Well, look, at Stephen, it's something that's been obvious since the opportunities to plant occurred back in January, that I would have expected that there was going to be a huge rush to get beans planted early, because early is a very useful element of the ripening date of the crop and of yield potential as well. But people have kind of stayed back as best they can from them. Like, to me, given where nitrogen prices are, having beans in the rotation is extremely useful as a way of decreasing your overall farm expenditure and therefore potential liability in these uncertain times. And I just thought it's a no-brainer for me in terms of putting beans in there. But I guess if you've grown beans in the past and you haven't gotten on very well with them, you know, that you've had some low yields, it may influence your decisions. And I think also that beans are not a crop that you sow in field situations that are not correct, which means relatively fertile in terms of P and K and having your pH quite high. They're critical things. I would also say that you need pretty good soil structure and good soil health for beans. That's where the advantage will always come in for that crop. But I would be disappointed if we don't hit our national area, because who knows where fertilizer prices are going to be next year. And one of the consequences of planting beans this year is that the crop that will follow it will have a lower fertilizer, specifically a lower nitrogen requirement next year. And in terms of decreasing farm liability to the increased costs that are still rife, it's just a very sensible thing to do. Plus the fact that they give an increased yield in the following crop, whatever that would be, and provide you with the opportunity to get a premium crop in following the beans. And all of those things are important for profitability, and rotations should never be judged on the single crop, but rather on the combined consequences of all of the crops in the rotation.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say, you know, you think those decisions were made before the war kicked off. But I guess, you know, with planting opportunities presenting themselves now over the coming days, and given everything that has happened in markets and the indication of travel, do you think will there be any last minute decisions made to either grow beans or to not grow beans in anticipation of higher cereal price?
I think they're both kind of mixed up, Stephen. Both ends of that question are inextricably linked. I can hear lots of people talking about the fact that we're going to gamble the grain because it's a more consistent performer over time, and I absolutely understand that as a decision for people to make. But I just think that more thought needs to be given to what beans do in the longer term, particularly when we move next year into a scenario where the aid levels will be higher again. Now, it's not inconceivable that people are trying to leave more land for beans next year when there's a potentially higher aid than this year. But that's not good rotational management. And who knows what policy changes may be in place for next year. And, you know, we keep talking about the fact that we might see an altered cap or a delay in the introduction of cap, which could equally mean a delay in the introduction of a new bean scheme. Look, they're just possibilities. They're not in any way something that's been talked about or muted. But, you know, you make the decision for the best decision of the day. And for some people, that will unquestionably be sow grain. But for lots of others, it probably should involve the inclusion of a pulse crop to decrease overall expenditure on fertilizer.
Okay, so sticking with that theme, the Ukraine-Russian war is raging on, and we are for another week dealing with the consequences on this side of the continent. The talk over the past 7 days has obviously been around feed and fodder supply coming into the winter and the pressures that we're likely to see. The the Fodder and Feed Committee met last Friday, which members of the Irish Farmers Journal was actually in attendance at, and we believe they're going to meet again next week. So as we understand it, really, the focus has shifted from a focus on growing grain and trying to increase our grain output to growing fodder and trying to maximise and increase our fodder area. With most of the government, I suppose, currently out of the country this week for St. Patrick's Day events around the world, it's likely to be next week before any solid proposals of any kind are made clear or even put to cabinet for approval. Andy, you have been writing about it as you see it on the tillage pages this week. Where do you think it's likely to land next week in terms of supports?
Well, look, it keeps changing all of the time, Stephen, and that's hardly surprising because the reaction is, in a sense, depending on news from elsewhere to some degree. There certainly is a will and a wish to try and get some increased grain production going. But I think the emphasis unquestionably is going to be and remain on fodder. You know, like, as we would have said from the word go, the easiest solution to increase fodder is for catch crops, forage catch crops to be planted after whatever cash crop is actually grown. That's the easiest one. And it's probably, one might say, likely that we will see a reappearance of that fodder production scheme. Now, that's, again, it's a guess. It's not that anybody has said that. There also was a bit of increased interest in trying to get more grassland, as in very extensively used grassland, into the tillage use, or into cropping. But that's not easy because, you know, a lot of that land is going to come up very low on fertility, low on pH. And while we might be able to correct pH easily, it might not be nearly as easy to get our hands on the volumes of fertilizer that would be needed to go in there. And also, I think it's important to say that, you know, any access to grassland would have to be a measure over a number of years rather than just 1 year. And whether or not anybody has an appetite to do that, we'll only have to wait and see. You know, it's difficult enough to get crops established in year one, particularly after old extensive lays with leather jackets, wireworms, crows, sods, you name it, the myriad of things that happen. Now, it's possible, but difficult and challenging. Because of that, you know, year one frequently is not a good experience for a lot of tillage farmers. And for to get a tillage farmer to go in there, you really have to be looking at a payback further down the road with better established crops and higher fertility, higher yield potential slots available to them as well.
Yeah, okay. Look, there's not really that much more we can say on this for now. We do expect to have a lot more information by this time next week. As I say, the National Food and Fodder Security Committee met last week. Will we meeting again next week as we understand it, and we should have more information by then. But of course, Andy, I mean, the real elephant in the room to any increase in the fodder area or tillage area, or even trying to increase silage production, is fertilizer. And there were some big issues with the fertilizer supply chain over the past 7 days. We've seen many merchants pulling prices, not actually giving quotes, and causing quite a bit of panic amongst those farmers who still haven't secured their fertilizer supplies. Do we have any update on what's going on?
Stephen, from my understanding, it appears to be related to the decisions to increase the intensity of sanctions that were made last week. Which basically, again, as I understand it, seem to introduce measures to try and prevent any element of trade benefit being able to move its way back to the ultimately to the pockets of the oligarchs that are controlling so much of everything that happens in Russia. And people will be aware of the consequences, the early consequences in terms of the sale of Chelsea Football Club, not exactly related directly to fertilizer, but it's now caught in the same boat, because while people had eventually learned what they needed to know and how to operate and mitigate the consequences of the early sanctions, when it comes to the more recent round, then some of those people in Russia have sold their businesses, and I'm going to guess relatively cleanly disposed of them. But the onus now is on the people who want to do business to prove that there can be no benefit to those particular people from any transactions that take place. And that's really after freezing trade of all kinds of things, like some of the fertilizer people told me in the week that they actually had ships loaded and out on the sea. And when this came into being, and all of a sudden, you know, you can't prove, you know, the person who owned the business has divested it and has removed himself from it. But can you prove that he has no other possible financial benefit to be got from that transaction? And it's a very difficult thing to prove. And it's actually freezing an amount of fertilizer that was en route, or ready to be loaded for this and other countries. And that's really what has played hell with situations in the last week, because if people can't actually get product at the price they have agreed it, then there is no guarantee what price will prevail when that product arrives, if it ever arrives. And that's where the problem is today.
I mean, it's a good point. You know, it's not the co-ops themselves or the merchants themselves. You know, they're working through importers. And the problem of Ireland is that we're an island in the far west of Europe, so we're really at the end of the supply chain, and we have no land bridge. And that's, as I understand it, Andy, is a big issue. It mightn't just be as severe an issue on continental Europe, where they can transport fertilizer, if they can get it by road.
Yeah, rail. if it's in the country at all, or even in a neighboring country, in theory it can be road shipped. But for us, everything has to come in by ship. And while we haven't heard of big issues with regard to the actual unloading of ships that arrive, there's just a real and very genuine concern that the ships that were to arrive either may not arrive or may be very considerably delayed.
To read a little bit more about that, flick over to page 8 on this week's Irish Farmers Journal. Again, a lot happening. Everything's moving quite fast. Things have changed considerably from this time last week, which is just an indication of the times that we're in. Okay, we'll move on here. And a shout out to John Murphy, while I'm at it, Tipperary tillage farmer, who was the overall winner of the Dairy Gold Malt and Barley competition for 2021. Read more about John on My Farming Week on page 4 of the newspaper this week. Andy, a big week for yourself and for Paul Mooney and for everyone else who was involved in the land report for 2021. It's available in shops through the paper this week. Give us an idea or an indication of the key insights which you've found this year.
Oh, Stephen, there are probably lots of them. I think the first thing that was noticeable, and it was noticeable all through last year, was that there seemed to be less land coming to the market. And I think that, you know, most other people who watch what's happening would be saying the same thing. But I think one of the things that we ask ourselves at the end of preparing for this year's report is access to the market like it used to be? Are we seeing farms being sold that are not being advertised? And it's very definitely an opinion of ours now that there is an amount of land moving hands or changing hands, which is not being advertised through any of the various media, at least the hard copy media. And we detect that there's a lot more of it going for digital advertising, or in some instances that we're picking up, no advertising at all, that neighbouring farmers trading land, changing land from one to the other, and possibly only with the solicitor involved, and the auctioneers maybe not being aware of it at all. So we're seeing considerable change, as is happening in everything else in life. We're seeing considerable change taking place in the whole presentation of land for market. In terms of the actual report itself, most areas will have recorded higher prices this year. Most counties will have recorded higher prices this year than in previous years. And the overall national price was up, kind of passing the 11,000 plus mark for the first time, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, in a big number of years. The price maybe didn't surprise a lot of people, but we've often seen in the past that we're anticipating price rises of 5-10%, but by the time you add in all of the small parcels that sold for relatively little money, the average that we found at the end of the day was always a bit lower than we had anticipated, possibly with the exception of this year. It is fair to say that the big prices are the ones that get all the publicity, and they're the ones that probably precondition us to expect that prices are higher. But lots of people in lots of counties are very conscious that they've seen more high prices in 2021 than they had in a number of the preceding years. And that is reflected in the overall figures in this report this year.
Yeah, no, it's a great piece of work, as always, county by county breakdown. I note that there's some commentary in relation to land being bought for rewilding and carbon offsetting. Is it just a one-off, do you think, Andy, or is this a trend that we're seeing?
I don't think it's one-off, Stephen. I think we saw that coming in initially about 2 years ago, But when you get kind of non-farming people buying it, you don't quite know what exactly it is that it's being bought for. But when you're seeing more of it being done, and when those people are, in a sense, declaring their interest in the land to the auctioneers to begin with, then you have a much better handle as to what exactly is going on, and the why and the wherefore that they're buying it. Like, we've had lots of business people buying land in recent years. They're buying it for for two reasons, I suppose, as part of a wealth transfer portfolio, and also as part of an opportunity to get tax-free income from that land in the interim if they go for the leases. But that land is still to be farmed. In these instances now, what we're seeing is that people are buying it with the intention of not farming it, to allow for carbon sequestration and long-term storage, and in that way to be able to use that land base either for their own use or for somebody else's use to offset carbon emissions into the future.
Yeah, no, very interesting. I know there was a case of a farm being bought in the locality up in my neck of the woods to be rewilded, and it's just a cry of shame, to be honest. And I think many farmers will feel the same about that. So, moving on, Andy, if I were to say to you, willow and miscanthus, what would be the first thing that comes to your mind?
The experiences of the mid and late 2000s. And yeah, the use of the planting grant, where there was no market and no effort to produce a market for them at the end of the growing season. So that's immediately what comes to mind, Stephen.
Oh, absolutely. You're bang on the money there. For anyone who doesn't know, I spent 2 years on this subject as part of my master's with Chagas, and it was an unmitigated disaster, really, was the only way to describe this, with the exception of a small handful of farmers who were able to make the crops work in a very close supply chain. Basically, as you said it, Andy, planting grant was available from the department to incentivize planting of willow and miscanthus crops right around the country. And to be fair, there was good uptick. Even up to 2015, there was still about 939 hectares of willow and about 2,414 hectares of miscanthus in the country. Now, that has dropped back to around about 270 hectares of willow and about 593 hectares of miscanthus. That was figures from 2020. Those are the latest ones we have, and we suspect they've gone down even more since. But a new report from the SEAI, the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, are anticipating a resurgence of these energy crops to some degree amongst farmers in a bid to increase our energy, our biomass supply to produce renewable heat. Interestingly, for anyone listening to us a couple of weeks ago, we would have spoken about the same report, which would have forecasted quite a dramatic reduction in the herd, the national herd, and in place the farmers would have been producing grass to feed feed anaerobic digestion plants. Well, they've actually modelled in the same dramatic reduction in a national herd, 45% approximately of the beef herd into this model, and suspect that a proportion of that ground is going to be used to grow willow and miscanthus. They reckon by 2050 or so there will be enough supply to produce about 4.2 terawatt hours of heat energy, which is substantial. I think they're living in fairyland, to be honest with you. I don't see this happening. Willow does grow well in Ireland, but it takes a very specialised supply chain to do it, and takes good ground. Miscanthus, I would not recommend anyone to go near, to be honest. And even at that, there's not even a suitable market for miscanthus. As I say, with the exception of one or two local supply chains, at least with willow, it could be burned in Eden Dairy if they would take it. But miscanthus, because of the high chlorine content, there's nowhere to go with it. So, interesting report from SEAI. A bit more information about it on the Tillage pages this week on page 43. Well worth checking out if you're interested in this space.
Stephen, so, before you leave that, sorry if I can just make a comment. You know, one can only agree or but agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying, because the negative experiences have been so strong in so many people's minds, and the talk all became negative from the scheme that was there before. But given where oil prices are gone and we're heading towards another harvest, it continues to amaze me why we have the potential to have grant aid for grain dryers that will burn diesel, and no easily accessible grant aid for people to put in and install solid fuel or renewable fuel type burners or boilers for grain drying. I appreciate that not everybody could do it based on their geographical location, but it seems to be such a simple way to go about addressing at least a quantity of the fuel used in Ireland from the point of view of controlling and containing emissions going forward. But yet I don't see anybody coming out suggesting that there should be grants for that, because it's a big capital investment.
Yeah, certainly not in a large scale, certainly not on a grain drying scale. There are smaller grants available for biomass systems for, you know, pig and poultry units through the SSRH support scheme for renewable heat, also administered by the SEA. But, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, Andy, I haven't heard too many good things about it. Certainly any farmers who have tried to apply for, well, it's a retrofit system or whatever, it's very difficult and very cumbersome, and lots of red tape to actually do this. So certainly there would need to be a rethink if that's what they were thinking. Now, don't get me wrong, if there was a decent biomass retrofit scheme for, you know, for grain dryers or maybe even for glass houses, if that came along first, followed by, you know, grant aid, generous grant aid for farmers to grow willow, and possibly some TAMS funding as well to support the investment in the supply chain, then maybe we might be able to make it work in a closed loop, tight supply chain. But not Miscanthus. I'd just say stay away from Miscanthus altogether. But you're right, Annie, there hasn't been much talk about it. In fact, this was the first recent report I would have seen around willow and Miscanthus, in recent times. So I don't know, do the SEA know something that we don't, or are they just clueless as to what has happened in the past? Time will tell, I guess. Okay, we'll move on. So, Andy, organic or not organic? That's not the question. According to our contributor on the sustainability pages this week, Robin Sulci, just explain to us in a nutshell what he has to say.
Well, it's an interesting take on the concept of organics by Roger. Roger worked in Ireland for many years with Chagask and Johnstown Castle, and has a kind of a good overall experience of agriculture here. And his experience with the Lighthouse Farms has taken him all over the world. And he says about half the farms in the Lighthouse scheme are organic and half are not organic. And he just gives a very quick overview of how organic can be made to work and how it can't be made to work. And he's basically saying that in some of the more recent experiences in parts of the world where whole regions of a country were converted to organic, that it can be very successful if people get sufficient notice of what's going to happen, if the emphasis can be put on education and knowledge transfer, and then if there are crops in that area being grown which particularly suit the area. Because the one thing that he's categorically saying in this is that if you have crops that don't naturally suit the geography of an area which require different inputs to make them happen, when you go organic, those crops suffer. And that's exactly what happened across different regions where these things were imposed on people. He gives an example of one country where it was imposed almost overnight and failed dramatically. He gave the other example of Cuba, which was made to be organic back in the time of the crisis, and because no inputs have been allowed, no Western inputs have been allowed in, And, you know, it worked because it has to work. But I'm sure there were consequences in the early years. So Roger is basically saying, you know, if you're going to go organic, you've got to think about where it's going to be used as a system and what use can be made of it, because it doesn't necessarily automatically fit into a replacement for the conventional agriculture in any area, in any part of the world.
Yeah, no, I've read it myself now. It's quite an interesting article and an essential read, I would say, for any policy listeners who are tuning into the pod, or any policy makers, sorry, who are tuning into the podcast. Andy, we'll move on in the interest of time. Let's take a look to grain markets this week. So obviously last week we've seen huge volatility, ups and downs. Have things leveled out a little bit this week, or where are we at?
Yes, Stephen, things certainly have leveled out considerably. I think from late last week, it became obvious that the level of volatility in the grain markets had lowered. It's not that prices were not going up and down, but they were maybe moving by 10 or 20 euro per day, as distinct from 20 to 50 euro per day before that, because of huge uncertainty. I think as people get into the crisis, they begin to better understand what the real numbers are, what the limitations are, and what the solutions are. And basically, as people got their head around that, the level of volatility was kind of lessened on an almost daily basis. And as we talk today, Wednesday, for Thursday's podcast, I'm looking at prices kind of falling since early morning, all positions out to harvest 2023 falling. December price, which is the one most people are looking at now, is back 5 euro a ton today for wheat, which basically means the same for barley. And at the minute of that I'm saying this, it's trading just over 340 in euro a ton. Now, the other thing that needs to be said is that physical prices are not necessarily following the futures prices exactly. Sometimes I see prices being offered in the market and you begin to wonder, where did that come from? And it could be on the high side or the low side, but it's very hard to be right, because I've seen a lot of prices being offered in the morning time, and by afternoon it looks to be a low price. But it was probably a good price that same morning. That's just what volatility does. The other one that's there is that there's kind of been a pretty dramatic drawback on the nearby price. I think when last we spoke, we would have referred to March as the nearby price on the Matif market. Because March is now halfway over, forward contracts are no longer available. So nearby contracts now move to May 2022 from March. So we're no longer seeing 400 plus appearing on the screens. And again, just at the point of stating this, the May contract, the last trade that was done today, was done at 380 euro a ton. So that's kind of fairly far back from the 450s that appeared on these screens a week and a half ago. So, you know, there's a bit of calmness coming back. I'm guessing, Stephen, what's happening at the moment is that the talk of the potential for progress in the talks between Ukraine and Russia is kind of easing the tension to some degree, and that's been reflected in overall prices. And I would be surprised if that's not actually been reflected across all markets and not just grain today.
That's interesting. That's interesting because obviously we're planting the crops and we're buying the inputs, you know, during that period of extreme volatility. You know, come harvest time, who knows where it's going to go, but we could be in there could be a peace settlement of some kind, you know, reached by Ukraine and Russia at that stage, which I'm assuming would depress markets, so it could easily go against us this year.
That's quite possible. I mean, I hope there will be peace. That's what all of course, us will hope for. But it's peace after the event rather than peace before. So there will inevitably be some consequences on the supply side for grains from this. That's absolutely inevitable, because there won't be the same volume of crops planted in Ukraine. But of course, we must remember that on the wheat side, a lot of it is already done, because most of the wheat there is winter sown. So it's really much more a matter of being able to manage that and having the inputs to manage that. And I don't know how farmers are fixed for, or sorry, in that regard. Do they have access to all the fertilizers they need? I can't imagine that they have any more than we have. Do they have access to the sprays? I'm guessing that's an even bigger problem for them than it is for us. So, you know, I think that we, no matter what happens, we're, I would say, inevitably going to see a reduction in output from Ukraine this year. Russia, of course, is a different kettle of fish because for them and for their people and their farmers, they just see life as business as usual while their neighbours suffer, unfortunately.
Okay, Andy, that will do us this week on the market front, and indeed it'll do us for the podcast. So there we are going to have to leave it. So for Andy and myself, Stephen Robb, thank you all very much for listening, and the very best of luck with your spring sowing campaign. Until next week, stay safe, stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.